thing and have no need to be perfect. When you are criticized, your initial response is investigative. Does the criticism contain a grain of truth? Just what did you do that was objectionable? Did you, in fact, goof up? Having defined the problem by asking a series of non-judgmental questions, you are in a position to propose a solution. If a compromise is indicated, you can negotiate. If you were clearly in the wrong, you can admit it. If the critic was mistaken, you can point this out in a tactful manner. But whether your behavior was right or wrong, you will know that you were right as a human being because you have finally perceived that your self-esteem was never at issue in the first place. Chapter 7. Feeling angry? What's your IQ? What's your IQ? I'm not interested in knowing how smart you are because your intelligence has little, if anything, to do with your capacity for happiness. What I want to know is what your irritability quotient is. This refers to the amount of anger and annoyance you tend to absorb and harbor in your daily life. If you have a particularly high IQ, it puts you at a great disadvantage because you overreact to frustrations and disappointments by creating feelings of resentment that blacken your disposition and make your life a joyless hassle. Here's how to measure your IQ. On the enhancement, you'll find the Novico Anger Scale, a list of 25 potentially upsetting situations. In the space provided on the questionnaire after each incident, estimate the degree it would ordinarily anger or provoke you, using the simple rating scale provided. Once you have completed the anger inventory, you are in a position to calculate your IQ, your irritability quotient. Now that you have completed the anger inventory, you are in a position to calculate your IQ, your irritability quotient. Make sure that you have not skipped any items. Add up your score for each of the 25 incidents. The lowest possible total score on the test would be 0. This would mean you put down a 0 on each item. This indicates you are either a liar or a guru. The highest score would be 100. This would mean you recorded a 4 on each of the 25 items, and you're constantly at or beyond the boiling point. You can now interpret your total score according to the following scale. 0 to 45. The amount of anger and annoyance you generally experience is remarkably low. Only a few percent of the population will score this low on the test. You are one of the select few. 46 to 55. You are substantially more peaceful than the average person. 56 to 75. You respond to life's annoyances with an average amount of anger. 76 to 85. You frequently react in an angry way to life's many annoyances. You are substantially more irritable than the average person. 86 to 100. You are a true anger champion, and you are plagued by frequent, intense, furious reactions that do not quickly disappear. You probably harbor negative feelings long after the initial insult has passed. You may have the reputation of a firecracker or a hothead among people you know. You may experience frequent tension headaches and elevated blood pressure. Your anger may often get out of control and lead to impulsive hostile outbursts, which at times get you into trouble. Only a few percent of the adult population react as intensely as you do. Now that you know how much anger you have, let's see what you can do about it. Traditionally, psychotherapists and the general public have conceptualized two primary ways to deal with anger. A. Anger turned inward, or B. Anger turned outward. The former solution is felt to be the sick one. You internalize your aggression and absorb resentment like a sponge. Ultimately, it corrodes you and leads to guilt and depression. Early psychoanalysts, such as Freud, felt that internalized anger was the cause of depression. Unfortunately, there is no convincing evidence in support of this notion. The second solution is said to be the healthy one. You express your anger, and as you ventilate your feelings, you presumably feel better. The problem with this simplistic approach is that it doesn't work very well. If you go around ventilating all your anger, people will soon regard you as loony, and at the same time, you aren't learning how to deal with people in society without getting angry. The cognitive solution transcends both of these. You have a third option. Stop creating your anger. You don't have to choose between holding it in or letting it out because it won't exist. In this chapter, I provide guidelines to help you assess the pros and cons of experiencing anger in a variety of situations so you can decide when anger is and isn't in your best self-interest. If you choose, you can develop control over your feelings. you will gradually cease to be plagued by excessive irritability and frustration that sour your life for no good reason. Just who is making you angry? People? Shit. I'm fed up with them. I need a vacation from people. The woman who recorded this thought at 2 a.m. couldn't sleep. How could the dogs and noisy neighbors in her apartment building be so thoughtless? Like her, I'll bet you're convinced it's other people's stupid, self-centered actions that make you angry. It's natural to believe that external events upset you. When you're mad at someone, you automatically make them the cause of all your bad feelings. You say, "You're annoying me. You're getting on my nerves." When you think like this, you're actually fooling yourself because other people really cannot make you angry. Yes, you heard me right. A pushy teenager might crowd in front of you in line at the movie theater. A con artist might sell you a fake ancient coin at an antique shop. A friend might screw you out of your share of a profitable business deal. Your boyfriend might always show up late for dates, in spite of his knowing how important promptness is to you. No matter how outrageous or unfair others might appear to you, they do not, never did, and never will upset you. The bitter truth is that you're the one who's creating every last ounce of the outrage you experience. Does that sound like heresy or stupidity to you? If you think I'm contradicting the obvious, you may feel like burning this book or throwing it down in disgust. If so, I dare you to read on, because anger, like all emotions, is created by your cognitions. The relationship between your thoughts and your anger is shown in Figure 7-1 on the enhanced portion of this audiobook. As you will note, before you can feel irritated by any event, you must first become aware of what is occurring and come to your own interpretation of it. Your feelings result from the meaning you give to the event, not from the event itself. For example, suppose that after a hectic day you put your 2-year-old child asleep in his crib for the night. You close his bedroom door and sit down to relax and watch television. 20 minutes later, he suddenly opens the door to his room and walks out, giggling. You might react to this in a variety of ways, depending on the meaning you attach to it. If you feel irritated, you're probably thinking, "Damn it, he's always a bother. Why can't he stay in bed and behave like he should? He never gives me a minute's rest." On the other hand, you could be delighted to see him pop out of his room because you're thinking, "Great, he just crawled out of his crib on his own for the first time. He's growing up and getting more independent." The event is the same in both cases. Your emotional reaction is determined entirely by the way you are thinking about the situation. I'll bet I know what you're thinking now. That example with the baby is not applicable. When I get angry, there's a justifiable provocation. There's plenty of genuine unfairness and cruelty in this world. There's no valid way I can think about all the crap I have to put up with each day without getting uptight. Do you want to perform a lobotomy and turn me into an unfeeling zombie? No thanks. You are certainly right that plenty of genuinely negative events do go on every day. But your feelings about them are still created by the interpretations you place on them. Take a careful look at these interpretations, because anger can be a two-edged sword. The consequences of an impulsive outburst will frequently defeat you in the long run. Even if you are being genuinely wronged, it may not be to your advantage to feel angry about it. The pain and suffering you inflict on yourself by feeling outraged may far exceed the impact of the original insult. As a woman who runs a restaurant put it, "Sure, I have the right to fly off the handle. The other day I realized the chefs forgot to order ham again, even though I had specifically reminded them. So I exploded and threw a cauldron of hot soup across the kitchen floor in disgust. 2 minutes later, I knew I'd acted like the biggest asshole in the world, but I didn't want to admit it. So I had to spend all my energy for the next 48 hours trying to convince myself I had the right to make a jackass of myself in front of 20 employees. It wasn't worth it." In many cases, your anger is created by subtle cognitive distortions. As with depression, many of your perceptions are twisted, one-sided, or just plain wrong. As you learn to replace these distorted thoughts with others that are more realistic and functional, you will feel less irritable and gain greater self-control. What kinds of distortion occur most often when you are angry? One of the greatest offenders is labeling. When you describe the person you're mad at as a jerk or a bum or a piece of shit, you see him in a totally negative way. You could call this extreme form of overgeneralization globalizing or monsterizing. Someone may in fact have betrayed your trust, and it is absolutely right to resent what the person did. In contrast, when you label someone, you create the impression that he or she has a bad essence. You are directing your anger toward what that person is. When you write people off this way, you catalog in your mind's eye every single thing about them you don't like, the mental filter, and ignore or discount their good points, disqualifying the positive. This is how you set up a false target for your anger. In reality, every human being is a complex mix of positive, negative, and neutral attributes. Labeling is a distorted thinking process that causes you to feel inappropriately indignant and morally superior. It's destructive to build your self-image this way. Your labeling will inevitably give way to your need to blame the other person. Your thirst for retaliation intensifies the conflict and brings out similar attitudes and feelings in the person you're mad at. Labeling inevitably functions as a self-fulfilling prophecy. You polarize the other person and bring about a state of interpersonal warfare. What's the battle really all about? Often you're involved in a defense of your self-esteem. The other person may have threatened you by insulting or criticizing you, or by not loving or liking you, or by not agreeing with your ideas. Consequently, you may perceive yourself in a duel of honor to the death. The problem with this is that the other person is not a totally worthless shit, no matter how much you insist. And furthermore, you cannot enhance your own esteem by denigrating someone else, even if it does feel good temporarily. Ultimately, only your own negative distorted thoughts can take away your self-respect, as pointed out in Chapter 4. There is one and only one person in this world who has the power to threaten your self-esteem, and that is you. Your sense of worth can go down only if you put yourself down. The real solution is to put an end to your absurd inner harangue. Another distortion characteristic of anger-generating thoughts is mind-reading. You invent motives that explains to your satisfaction why the other person did what he or she did. These hypotheses are frequently erroneous because they will not describe the actual thoughts and perceptions that motivated the other person. Due to your indignation, it may not occur to you to check out what you are saying to yourself. Common explanations you might offer for the other person's objectionable behavior would be, he has a mean streak, she's unfair, he's just like that, she's stupid, they're bad kids, and so forth. The problem with these so-called explanations is that they are just additional labels that don't really provide any valid information. In fact, they are downright misleading. Here's an example. Joan got hot under the collar when her husband told her he'd prefer to watch the Sunday football game on TV rather than go with her to a concert. She felt miffed because she told herself, he doesn't love me. He always has to get his own way. It's unfair. The problem with Joan's interpretation is that it is not valid. He does love her. He doesn't always get his way, and he isn't intentionally being unfair. On this particular Sunday, the Dallas Cowboys are locking spurs with the Pittsburgh Steelers, and he really wants to see that game. There's no way he's going to want to get dressed and go to a concert. When Joan thinks about her husband's motivations in such an illogical fashion, she creates two problems for the price of one. She has to put up with the self-created illusion that she's unloved, in addition to missing out on his company at the concert. The third form of distortion that leads to anger is magnification. If you exaggerate the importance of the negative event, the intensity and duration of your emotional reaction may get blown up out of all proportion. For example, if you're waiting for a late bus and you have an important appointment, you might tell yourself, I can't take this. Isn't that a slight exaggeration? Since you are taking it, you can take it, so why tell yourself you can't? The inconvenience of waiting for the bus is bad enough without creating additional discomfort and self-pity in this way. Do you really want to fume like that? Inappropriate should and shouldn't statements represent the fourth type of distortion that feeds your anger. When you find that some people's actions are not to your liking, you tell yourself they shouldn't have done what they did, or they should have done something they failed to do. For example, suppose you register at a hotel and discover they lost the record of your reservation, and now there are no rooms available. You furiously insist, this shouldn't have happened, those stupid goddamn clerks. Does the actual deprivation cause your anger? No. The deprivation can only create a sense of loss, disappointment, or inconvenience. Before you can feel anger, you must necessarily make the interpretation you are entitled to get what you want in this situation. Consequently, you see the goof-up on your reservation as an injustice. This perception leads to your feeling angry. So what's wrong with that? When you say the clerks shouldn't have made a mistake, you are creating unnecessary frustration for yourself. It's unfortunate your reservation was lost, but it's highly unlikely anyone intended to treat you unjustly, or that the clerks are especially stupid. But they did make an error. When you insist on perfection from others, you will simply make yourself miserable and become immobilized. Here's the rub. Your anger probably won't cause a room to appear magically, and the inconvenience of going to another hotel will be far less than the misery you inflict on yourself by brooding for hours or days about the lost reservation. Irrational should statements rest on your assumption that you are entitled to instant gratification at all times. So on those occasions when you don't get what you want, you go into panic or rage because of your attitude that, unless you get X, you will either die or be tragically deprived of joy forever. X can represent love, affection, status, respect, promptness, perfection, niceness, etc. This insistence that your wants be gratified at all times is the basis for much self-defeating anger. People who are anger-prone often formulate their desires in moralistic terms, such as this: if I'm nice to someone, they should be appreciative. Other people have free will and often think and act in ways that aren't to your liking. All of your insistence that they must fall in line with your desires and wishes will not produce this result. The opposite is more often true. Your attempts to coerce and manipulate people with angry demands most often will alienate and polarize them and make them much less likely to want to please you. This is because other people don't like being controlled or dominated any more than you do. Your anger will simply limit the creative possibilities for problem solving. The perception of unfairness or injustice is the ultimate cause of most, if not all, anger. In fact, we could define anger as the emotion which corresponds in a one-to-one manner to your belief that you are being treated unfairly. Now we come to a truth you may see either as a bitter pill or an enlightening revelation. There is no such thing as a universally accepted concept of fairness and justice. There is an undeniable relativity of fairness, just as Einstein showed the relativity of time and space. Einstein postulated, and it has since been experimentally validated, there is no absolute time that is standard throughout the universe. Time can appear to speed up and slow down, and is relative to the frame of reference of the observer. Similarly, absolute fairness does not exist. Fairness is relative to the observer, and what is fair to one person can appear quite unfair to another. Even social rules and moral strictures, which are accepted within one culture, can vary substantially in another. You can protest that this is not the case and insist that your own personal moral system is universal, but it just ain't so. Here's proof. When a lion devours a sheep, is this unfair? From the point of view of the sheep, it is unfair. He's being viciously and intentionally murdered with no provocation. From the point of view of the lion, it is fair. He's hungry, and this is the daily bread he feels entitled to. Who is right? There is no ultimate or universal answer to this question because there's no absolute fairness floating around to resolve the issue. In fact, fairness is simply a perceptual interpretation, an abstraction, a self-created concept. How about when you eat a hamburger? Is this unfair? To you, it's not. From the point of view of the cow, it certainly is, or was. Who's right? There is no ultimate, true answer. In spite of the fact that absolute fairness does not exist, personal and social moral codes are important and useful. I am not recommending anarchy. I am saying that moral statements and judgments about fairness are stipulations, not objective facts. Social moral systems, such as the Ten Commandments, are essentially sets of rules that groups decide to abide by. One basis for such systems is the enlightened self-interest of each member of the group. If you fail to act in a manner that takes into account the feelings and interests of others, you are likely to end up less happy because sooner or later they will retaliate when they notice you are taking advantage of them. A system which defines fairness varies in its generality depending on how many people accept it. When a rule of behavior is unique to one person, other people may see it as eccentric. An example of this would be my patient who washes her hands ritualistically over 50 times a day to set things right and to avoid extreme feelings of guilt and anxiety. When a rule is nearly universally accepted, it becomes part of a general moral code and may become a part of the body of law. The prohibition against murder is an example. Nevertheless, no amount of general acceptance can make such systems absolute or ultimately valid for everyone under all circumstances. Much everyday anger results when we confuse our own personal wants with general moral codes. When you get mad at someone and you claim that they are acting unfairly, more often than not, what is really going on is they are acting fairly relative to a set of standards and frame of reference that differs from yours. Your assumption that they are being unfair implies that your way of looking at things is universally accepted. For this to be the case, everyone would have to be the same, but we aren't. We all think differently. When you overlook this and blame the other person for being unfair, you are unnecessarily polarizing the interaction because the other person will feel insulted and defensive. Then the two of you will argue fruitlessly about who is right. The whole dispute is based on the illusion of absolute fairness. Because of your relativity of fairness, there is a logical fallacy that is inherent in your anger. Although you feel convinced the other guy is acting unfairly, you must realize he is only acting unfairly relative to your value system. But he is operating from his value system, not yours. More often than not, his objectionable action will seem quite fair and reasonable to him. Therefore, from his point of view, which is his only possible basis for action, what he does is fair. Do you want people to act fairly? Then you should want him to act as he does, even though you dislike what he does, since he is acting fairly within his system. You can work to try to convince him to change his attitudes and ultimately modify his standards and his actions, and in the meantime, you can take steps to make certain you won't suffer as a result of what he does. But when you tell yourself he's acting unfairly, you are fooling yourself and you are chasing a mirage. Does this mean that all anger is inappropriate and that the concepts of fairness and morality are useless because they are relative? Some popular writers do give this impression. Dr. Wayne Dyer writes, "We are conditioned to look for justice in life, and when it doesn't appear, we tend to feel anger, anxiety, or frustration. Actually, it would be equally productive to search for the fountain of youth, or some such myth. Justice does not exist. It never has, and it never will. The world is simply not put together that way. Robins eat worms. That's not fair to the worms. You have only to look at nature to realize there is no justice in the world. Tornadoes, floods, tidal waves, droughts are all unfair." This position represents the opposite extreme and is an example of all-or-nothing thinking. It's like saying, throw your watches and clocks away because Einstein showed that absolute time does not exist. The concepts of time and fairness are socially useful, even though they do not exist in an absolute sense. In addition to this contention that the concept of fairness is an illusion, Dr. Dyer seems to suggest that anger is useless. You may accept anger as a part of your life, but do you realize it serves no utilitarian purpose? You do not have to possess it, and it serves no purpose that has anything to do with being a happy, fulfilled person. The irony of anger is that it never works in changing others. Again, his arguments seem to be based on cognitive distortion. To say anger serves no purpose is just more all-or-nothing thinking, and to say it never works is an overgeneralization. Actually, anger can be adaptive and productive in certain situations. So the real question is not, should I or should I not feel anger, but rather, where will I draw the line? The following two guidelines will help you to determine when your anger is productive and when it is not. These two criteria can help you synthesize what you are learning and to evolve a meaningful personal philosophy about anger. One, is my anger directed towards someone who has knowingly, intentionally, and unnecessarily acted in a hurtful manner? Two, is my anger useful? Does it help me achieve a desired goal, or does it simply defeat me? Example, you are playing basketball and a fellow on the other team elbows you in the stomach intentionally so as to upset you and get you off your game. You may be able to channel your anger productively so you will play harder and win. So far, your anger is adaptive. Once the game is over, you may no longer want that anger. Now it's maladaptive. Suppose your 3-year-old son runs mindlessly into the street and risks his life. In this case, he is not intentionally inflicting harm. Nevertheless, the angry mode in which you express yourself may be adaptive. The emotional arousal in your voice conveys a message of alarm and importance that might not come across if you were to deal with him in a calm, totally objective manner. In both these examples, you chose to be angry, and the magnitude and expression of the emotion were under your control. The adaptive and positive effects of your anger differentiate it from hostility, which is impulsive and uncontrolled and leads to aggression. Suppose you are enraged about some senseless violence you read about in the paper. Here the act seems clearly hurtful and immoral. Nevertheless, your anger may not be adaptive if, as is usually the case, there is nothing you plan to do about it. If, in contrast, you choose to help the victims or begin a campaign to fight crime in some way, your anger might again be adaptive. Keeping these two criteria in mind, let me give you a series of methods you can use to reduce your anger in those situations where it is not in your best interest. Develop the desire. Anger can be the most difficult emotion to modify because when you get mad, you will be like a furious bulldog, and persuading you to stop sinking your teeth into the other person's leg can be extremely tough. You won't really want to rid yourself of those feelings because you will be consumed by the desire for revenge. After all, because anger is caused by what you perceive to be unfair, it is a moral emotion, and you will be extremely hesitant to let go of the righteous feeling. You will have the nearly irresistible urge to defend and justify your anger with religious zeal. Overcoming this will require an act of great willpower, so why bother? The first step, use the double column technique to make a list of the advantages and disadvantages of feeling angry and acting in a retaliatory manner. Consider both the short and long-term consequences of your anger. Then review the list and ask yourself which are greater, the costs or the benefits. This will help you determine if your resentment is really in your best self-interest. Since most of us ultimately want what's best for us, this can pave the way for a more peaceful and productive attitude. Here's how it works. Sue is a 31-year-old woman with 2 daughters from a previous marriage. Her husband John is a hard-working lawyer with 1 teenage daughter from his prior marriage. Because John's time is very limited, Sue often feels deprived and resentful. She told me she felt he wasn't giving her a fair shake in the marriage because he was not giving her enough of his time and attention. She listed the advantages and disadvantages of her irritability, and you can see for yourself in Figure 7-2 on the enhancement. She also made a list of the positive consequences that might result from eliminating her anger. 1. People will like me better. They will want to be near me. 2. I will be more predictable. 3. I will be in better control of my emotions. 4. I will be more relaxed. 5. I will be more comfortable with myself. 6. I will be viewed as a positive, non-judgmental, practical person. 7. I will behave more often as an adult than as a child who has to get what it wants. 8. I will influence people more effectively, and I'll get more of what I want through assertive, calm, rational negotiation than through tantrums and demands. And 9. My kids, husband, and parents will respect me more. As a result of this assessment, Sue told me she was convinced that the price of her anger substantially exceeded the benefits. It is crucial that you perform this same type of analysis as a first step in coping with your anger. After you list the advantages and disadvantages of your anger, give yourself the same test. Ask yourself, if the upsetting situation that provokes me doesn't change immediately, would I be willing to cope with it instead of getting angry? If you can answer yes, then you are clearly motivated to change. You will probably succeed in gaining greater inner peace and self-esteem, and you will increase your effectiveness in life. This choice is up to you. Cool those hot thoughts. Once you've decided to cool down, an invaluable method that can help you is to write down the various hot thoughts that are going through your mind when you are upset. Then substitute less upsetting, more objective, cool thoughts using the double column method as shown in Figure 7-3 on the enhancement. Listen for those hot thoughts with your third ear so as to tune in to the antagonistic statements that go through your head. Record this private dialogue without any censorship. I'm sure you'll notice all kinds of highly colorful language and vengeful fantasies. Write them all down. Then substitute cool thoughts that are more objective and less inflammatory. This will help you feel less aroused and overwhelmed. Sue used this technique to deal with the frustration she felt when John's daughter Sandy acted manipulative and wrapped John around her finger. Sue kept telling him to be more assertive with Sandy and less of a soft touch, but he often reacted negatively to her suggestions. He felt Sue was nagging and making demands to get her way. This made him want to spend even less time with her, which contributed to a vicious cycle. Sue wrote down the hot thoughts that made her feel jealous and guilty, see figure 7-3. As she substituted cool thoughts, she felt better, and this served as an antidote to her urge to try to control John. Although she still felt he was wrong in letting Sandy manipulate him, she decided he had the right to be wrong. Consequently, Sue pushed John less, and he began to feel less pressured. Their relationship improved and ripened in a climate of mutual freedom and respect. Simply talking back to her hot thoughts was, of course, not the only ingredient that led to a successful second marriage for Sue and John, but it was a necessary and gigantic first step without which both of them could have easily ended up stalemated again. You can also use the more elaborate chart, the daily record of dysfunctional thoughts, to deal with your anger, as found in Figure 7-4 on the enhanced portion of this audiobook. You can describe the provocative situation and assess how angry you feel before and after you do the exercise. Figure 7-4 shows how a young woman coped with her frustration when she was dealt with tersely by a prospective employer over the telephone. She reported that pinpointing her hot thoughts and putting the lie to them helped her nip an emotional explosion in the bud. This prevented the fretting and fuming that normally would have soured her entire day. She told me, "Before I did the exercise, I thought my enemy was the man on the other end of the phone. But I learned that I was treating myself 10 times worse than he was. Once I recognized this, it was relatively easy to substitute cooler thoughts, and I surprised myself by feeling a whole lot better right away." Imagining techniques. Those negative hot thoughts that go through your mind when you are angry represent the script of a private movie, usually X-rated, that you project onto your mind. Have you ever noticed the picture on the screen? The images, daydreams, and fantasies of revenge and violence can be quite colorful indeed. You may not be aware of these mental pictures unless you look for them. Let me illustrate. Suppose I ask you to visualize a red apple in a brown basket right now. You can do this with your eyes open or closed. There. Do you see it now? That's what I'm referring to. Most of us have these visual images all day long. They are a part of normal consciousness, the pictorial illustrations of our thoughts. For example, memories sometimes occur to us as mental pictures. Conjure up an image now of some vivid past event, your high school graduation, your first kiss, do you still remember it, a long hike, etc. Do you see it now? These images can affect you strongly, and their influence can be positively or negatively arousing, just like erotic dreams or nightmares. The exhilarating effect of a positive image can be intense. For instance, on your way to an amusement park, you might have an image of that first dazzling descent down the roller coaster, and you may experience the excited rush in your belly. The daydream actually creates the pleasurable anticipation. Similarly, negative images play a powerful role in your level of emotional arousal. Visualize right now someone whom you've gotten good and mad at sometime in your life. What images come to mind? Do you imagine punching them in the nose or tossing them into a vat of boiling oil? These daydreams actually keep your anger alive long after the initial insult has occurred. Your sense of rage may eat away at you for hours, days, months, or even years after the irritating event has long since passed. Your fantasies help keep the pain alive. Every time you fantasize about the occurrence, you shoot new doses of arousal into your system. You become like a cow chewing on poisoned cud, and who is creating this anger? You are. Because you chose to put those images in your mind. For all you know, the person you were mad at lives in Timbuktu, or maybe isn't even alive anymore, so he or she could hardly be the culprit. You are the director and producer of the film now, and what's worse, you're the only one in the audience. Who has to watch and experience all the arousal? You do. You're the one who's subjected to a continual clenching, a tightening of back muscles, and an outpouring of adrenal hormones into the bloodstream. You're the one whose blood pressure is going up. In a nutshell, you're making yourself hurt. Do you want to keep this up? If not, you will want to do something to reduce the anger-generating images that you are projecting onto your mind. One helpful technique is to transform them in a creative way so they become less upsetting. Humor represents one powerful tool you can use. For example, instead of imagining wringing the neck of the person you are furious with, fantasize that he is walking around in diapers in a crowded department store. Visualize all the details: the pot belly, the diaper pins, the hairy legs. Now what's happening to your anger? Is that a broad smile spreading across your face? A second method involves thought stoppage. As you notice the images crossing your mind each day, remind yourself that you have the right to turn the projector off. Think about something else. Find someone and engage him or her in conversation. Read a good book, bake bread, go jogging. When you don't reward the anger images with your arousal, they will recur less and less often. Instead of dwelling on them, think about an upcoming event that excites you, or switch to an erotic fantasy. If the upsetting memory is persistent, engage in vigorous physical exercise, such as push-ups, rapid jogging, or swimming. These have the additional benefit of rechanneling your potentially hurtful arousal in a highly beneficial way. Rewrite the rules. You may frustrate and upset yourself needlessly because you have an unrealistic rule about personal relationships that causes you to be let down all the time. The key to Sue's anger was her belief she was entitled to John's love because of her rule. If I'm a good and faithful wife, I deserve to be loved. As a result of this innocent-sounding assumption, Sue experienced a constant sense of danger in her marriage because anytime John wasn't giving her an appropriate helping of love and attention, she would experience it as confirmation of her inadequacy. She would then manipulate and demand attention and respect in a constant battle to defend herself against a loss of self-esteem. Intimacy with him became like slipping slowly toward the edge of an icy cliff. No wonder she was desperately grabbing onto John. And no wonder she would explode when she sensed his indifference. Didn't he realize her life was at stake? In addition to the intense unpleasantness that her love rule created, it didn't work well in the long run. For a while, Sue's manipulations did, in fact, get her some of the attention she craved. After all, she could intimidate John with her emotional explosions. She could punish him with her icy withdrawal. And she could manipulate him by arousing his guilt. But the price Sue pays is that the love she receives isn't and can't be given freely and spontaneously. He will feel exhausted, trapped, and controlled. The resentment he's been storing up will press for release when he stops buying into her belief that he has to give in to her demands. His desire for freedom will overpower him, and he will explode. The destructive effects of what passes for love never cease to amaze me. If your relationships are characterized by this cyclic tension and tyranny, you may be better off rewriting the rules. If you adopt a more realistic attitude, you can end your frustration. It's much easier than trying to change the world. Sue decided to revise her love rule in the following way. If I behave in a positive manner toward John, he will respond in a loving way a good bit of the time. I can still respect myself and function effectively when he doesn't. This formulation of her expectations was more realistic and didn't put her moods and self-esteem at the mercy of her husband. The rules that get you into interpersonal difficulty often won't appear to be malignant. On the contrary, they often seem highly moral and humanistic. I recently treated a woman named Margaret who had the notion that marriages should be 50-50. Each partner should do for the other equally. She applied this rule to all human relationships. If I do nice things for people, they should reciprocate. So what's wrong with that? It certainly sounds reasonable and fair. It's a kind of a spin-off from the Golden Rule. Here's what's wrong with it. It's an undeniable fact that human relationships, including marriages, are rarely spontaneously reciprocal because people are different. Reciprocity is a transient and inherently unstable ideal that can only be approximated through continued effort. This involves mutual consensus, communication, compromise, and growth. It requires negotiation and hard work. Margaret's problem was that she didn't recognize this. She lived in a fairy tale world where reciprocity existed as an assumed reality. She went around always doing good things for her husband and others, and then waited for their reciprocity. Unfortunately, these unilateral contracts fell apart because other people usually weren't aware that she expected to be repaid. For example, a local charity organization advertised for a salaried assistant director to start in several months. Margaret was quite interested in this position and submitted her application. She then gave large amounts of her time doing volunteer work for the organization and assumed that the other employees would reciprocate by liking and respecting her, and that the director would reciprocate by giving her the job. In reality, the other employees did not respond to her warmly. Perhaps they sensed and resented her attempt to control them with her niceness and virtue. When the director chose another candidate for the position, she hit the roof and felt bitter and disillusioned because her reciprocity rule had been violated. Since her rule caused her so much trouble and disappointment, she opted to rewrite it and to view reciprocity not as a given, but as a goal she could work toward by pursuing her own self-interest. At the same time, she relinquished her demand that others read her mind and respond as she wanted. Paradoxically, as she learned to expect less, she got more. If you have a should or shouldn't rule that has been causing you disappointment and frustration, rewrite it in more realistic terms. A number of examples to help you do this are shown in Figure 7.5 on the enhancement. You will notice that the substitution of one word, "it would be nice if," in place of "should," can be a useful first step. Learn to expect craziness. As the anger in Sue's relationship with John cooled down, they became closer and more loving. However, John's daughter, Sandy, responded to his increased intimacy by even greater manipulations. She began to lie, borrowed money without returning it. She sneaked into Sue's bedroom, went through drawers, and stole Sue's personal items. She left the kitchen messy, etc. All these actions effectively got Sue's goat because she told herself, "Sandy shouldn't act so sneaky. She's crazy. It's unfair." Sue's sense of frustration was the product of two necessary ingredients. One, Sandy's obnoxious behavior. Two, Sue's expectation that she should act in a more mature way. Since the evidence suggested that Sandy wasn't about to change, Sue had only one alternative. She could discard her unrealistic expectation that Sandy behave in an adult, ladylike fashion. She decided to write the following memo to herself entitled, "Why Sandy Should Act Obnoxiously." It is Sandy's nature to be manipulative because she believes that she's entitled to love and attention. She believes that getting love and attention is a matter of life and death. She thinks she needs to be the center of attention in order to survive. Therefore, she will see any lack of love as unfair and a great danger to her sense of self-esteem. Because she feels she has to manipulate in order to get attention, she should act in a manipulative way. Therefore, I can expect and predict that she will continue to act this way until she changes. Since it is unlikely that she will change in the near future, I can expect her to continue to behave this way for a period of time. Therefore, I will have no reason to feel frustrated or surprised, because she will be acting the way she should act. Furthermore, I want all humans, including Sandy, to act in a manner that they believe to be fair. Sandy feels she's entitled to more attention. Since her obnoxious behavior is based on her sense of entitlement, I can remind myself that what she does is fair from her point of view. Finally, I want my moods to be under my control, not hers. Do I want to make myself feel upset and angry at her fair, obnoxious behavior? No. Therefore, I can begin to change the way I react to her. One, I can thank her for stealing, since this is what she should do. Two, I can laugh to myself about her manipulations, since they are childish. Three, I can choose not to be angry unless it is my decision to use the anger to accomplish a specific goal. Four, if I feel a loss of self-esteem due to Sandy's manipulations, I can ask myself, do I want to give a child such power over me? What is the desired effect of such a memorandum? Sandy's provocative actions are probably knowingly malicious. Sandy consciously targets Sue because of the resentment and helpless frustration she feels. When Sue gets upset, she paradoxically gives Sandy exactly what she wants. She can greatly reduce her frustration as she changes her expectations. Enlightened manipulation. You may fear that you will be a pushover if you change your expectations and give up your anger. You might sense that other people would take advantage of you. This apprehension reflects your sense of inadequacy as well as the fact that you probably have not been trained in more enlightened methods of going after what you want. You probably believe that if you didn't make demands on people, you'd end up empty-handed. So, what's the alternative? Well, as a starting point, let's review the work of Dr. Mark K. Goldstein, a psychologist who has done some brilliant and creative clinical research on the behavioral conditioning of husbands by wives. In his work with neglected and angry wives, he became aware of the self-defeating methods they used to get what they wanted from their husbands. He asked himself, what have we learned in the laboratory about the most effective scientific methods for influencing all living organisms, including bacteria, plants, and rats? Can we apply these principles to wayward and sometimes brutal husbands? The answer to these questions was straightforward. Reward the desired behavior instead of punishing the undesired behavior. Punishment causes aversion and resentment and brings about alienation and avoidance. Most of the deprived and abandoned wives he treated were misguidedly trying to punish their husbands into doing what they wanted. By switching them to a reward model in which the desired behavior got copious attention, he observed some dramatic turnabouts. The wives Dr. Goldstein treated were not unique. They were ensnarled in the ordinary marital conflicts that most of us confront. These women had a long history of giving their spouses attention either indiscriminately or, in some cases, primarily in response to undesirable behavior. A major shift had to occur in order for them to elicit the kind of response they desired from their husbands, but were not getting. By keeping meticulous scientific records of their interactions with their husbands, the women were able to achieve control over how they responded. Here's how it worked for one of Dr. Goldstein's patients. After years of fighting, wife X reported she lost her husband. He abandoned her and moved in with his girlfriend. His primary interactions with wife X had centered around abuse and indifference. It appeared on the surface as if he didn't care much about her. Nevertheless, he did call her occasionally, indicating he might have some interest in her. She had the choice of cultivating this attention or crushing it further by continued inappropriate responses. Wife X defined her goals. She would experiment to see if she could, in fact, get her husband back. The first milestone would be to determine if she could effectively increase his rate of contact with her. She measured meticulously the frequency and duration of his every telephone call and visit home, recording this information on a piece of graph paper taped to the refrigerator door. She carefully assessed the crucial relationship between her behavior, the stimulus, and the frequency of his contacts, the response. She initiated no contact with him at all on her own, but instead responded positively and affectionately to his calls. Her strategy was straightforward. Rather than noticing and reacting to all the things about him that she didn't like, she began to reinforce systematically those that she did like. The rewards she used were all the things that turned him on: praise, food, sex, affection, etc. She began by responding to his rare calls in an upbeat, positive, complimentary manner. She flattered and encouraged him. She avoided any criticism, argument, demands, or hostility, and found a way to agree with everything he said, using the disarming technique described in Chapter 7. Initially, she terminated all these calls after 5 to 10 minutes to ensure the likelihood the conversations would not deteriorate into an argument or become boring to him. This guaranteed that her feedback would be pleasant to him, and that his response to it would not be suppressed or eliminated. After she did this a few times, she noticed her husband began to call more and more frequently because the calls were positive, rewarding experiences for him. She noted this increased rate of telephoning on her graph paper just as a scientist observes and documents the actions of an experimental rat. As his phone calls increased, she began to feel encouraged, and some of her irritation and resentment melted away. One day he appeared at the house, and according to her plan, she announced, "I'm so happy you dropped by because I just happen to have a fresh, fancy imported Cuban cigar in the freezer for you. It's the expensive type you really like." She actually had a whole box of them waiting, so she was able to repeat this each time he visited, regardless of why or when he came. She noticed the frequency of his visits substantially increased. In a similar manner, she continued to shape his behavior using rewards rather than coercion. She realized how successful she had been when her husband decided to leave his girlfriend and asked if he could move back in with her. Am I saying that is the only way to relate and to influence people? No, that would be absurd. It's just a pleasant spice, not the whole banquet or even the main course. But it's a frequently overlooked delicacy that few appetites can resist. There's no guarantee it will work. Some situations may be irreversible, and you can't always get what you want. At any rate, try the upbeat reward system. You may be pleasantly surprised at the remarkable effectiveness of your secret strategy. In addition to motivating the people you care about to want to be around you, it will improve your mood because you learn to notice and focus on the positive things that others do rather than dwell on their negatives. Should reduction. Because many of the thoughts which generate your anger involve moralistic should statements, it will help you to master some should removal methods. One way is to make a list using the double column method of all the reasons why you believe the other person shouldn't have acted as he did. Then challenge these reasons until you can see why they are unrealistic and don't actually make good sense. Example, suppose the carpenter on your new house did a sloppy job on the kitchen cabinets. The doors are poorly aligned and don't close properly. You feel irate because you see this as unfair. After all, you paid full union wages, so you feel entitled to excellent workmanship from a top craftsman. You fume as you tell yourself, the lazy bastard should take some pride in his work. What's the world coming to? You list the reasons and rebuttals detailed in Figure 7-6 on the enhanced portion of this audiobook. The rationale for eliminating your should statement is simple. It's not true that you are entitled to get what you want just because you want it. You'll have to negotiate. Call the carpenter, complain, and insist the job be corrected. But don't double your trouble by making yourself excessively hot and bothered. The carpenter probably wasn't trying to hurt you, and your anger might simply polarize him and put him on the defensive. After all, half of all the carpenters and psychiatrists, secretaries, writers and dentists, etc., throughout human history have been below average. Do you believe that? It's true by definition, because average is defined as the halfway point. It's ludicrous to fume and complain that this particular carpenter's average talent is unfair or that he should be other than he is. Negotiating strategies. At this point, you may be bristling because you're thinking, well, that's a fine kettle of fish. Dr. Byrne seems to be telling me I can find happiness by believing that lazy, incompetent carpenters should do mediocre work. After all, it's their nature, the good doctor claims. What weak-spined hogwash! I'm not going to be stripped of my human dignity and let people walk all over me and get away with second-rate crappy work I'm paying a fortune for. Cool down. Nobody's asking you to let the carpenter pull the wool over your eyes. If you want to exert your influence in an effective way instead of moping angrily and creating inner turmoil, a calm, firm, assertive approach will usually be the most successful. Moralistic shoulding, in contrast, will simply aggravate you and polarize him, and cause him to feel defensive and to counterattack. Remember, fighting is a form of intimacy. Do you really want to be so intimate with this carpenter? Wouldn't you prefer to get what you want instead? As you stop consuming your energy and anger, you can focus your efforts on getting what you want. The following negotiating principles can work effectively in such a situation. 1. Instead of telling him off, compliment him on what he did right. It's an undeniable fact of human nature that few people can resist flattery even if it's blatantly insincere. However, since you can find something good about him or his work, you can make your compliment honest. Then mention the problem with the cupboard doors tactfully and calmly explain why you want him to come back and correct the alignment. 2. Disarm him if he argues by finding a way to agree with him regardless of how absurd his statements are. This will shut him up and take the wind out of his sails. Then, immediately, 3. Clarify your point of view again, calmly and firmly. Repeat the above 3 techniques over and over in varying combinations, until the carpenter finally gives in or an acceptable compromise is reached. Use ultimatums and intimidating threats only as a last resort, and make sure you are ready and willing to follow through when you do. As a general principle, use diplomacy in expressing your dissatisfaction with his work. Avoid labeling him in an insulting way or implying he is bad, evil, malignant, etc. If you decide to tell him about your negative feelings, do so objectively without magnification or an excess of inflammatory language. For example, "I resent shoddy work when I feel you have the ability to do a good professional job," is far preferable to "you mother blank, your blank work is an outrage." In the following dialogue, I will identify each of these techniques. You, I was pleased with how some of the work came out, and I'm hopeful I'll be able to tell other people I was happy with the whole job. The paneling was especially well done. I'm a little concerned about the kitchen cabinets, however.
Compliment.
Carpenter. What seems to be the trouble? The doors aren't lined up, and many of the handles are on crooked. Well, that's about the best I can do on those kinds of cabinets. They're mass-produced, and they just aren't made the best. Well, that's true. They aren't as well made as a more expensive type might be. Disarming technique. Nevertheless, they aren't acceptable this way, and I'd appreciate it if you'd do something to make them more presentable.
Clarification.
Tact. You'll have to talk to the manufacturer, the builder. There's nothing I can do about it.
I can understand your frustration. Disarming technique. But it's your responsibility to complete these cabinets to our satisfaction. They're simply not acceptable. They look shoddy, and they don't close properly. I know it's an inconvenience, but my position is that the job can't be considered complete, and the bill won't be paid until you've corrected it.
Ultimatum. I can see from your other work that you had the skill to make them look right in spite of the extra time it will take. That way, we'll be completely satisfied with your work, and we can give you a good recommendation.
Compliment.
Try these negotiating techniques when you are at a loggerheads with someone. I think you'll find they work more effectively than blowing your stack. And you'll feel better because you'll usually end up getting more of what you want.
Accurate empathy.
Empathy is the ultimate anger antidote. It's the highest form of magic described in this book, and its spectacular effects are firmly entrenched in reality. No trick mirrors are needed.
Let's define the word.
By empathy, I do not mean the capacity to feel the same way someone else feels. This is sympathy. Sympathy is highly touted, but is, in my opinion, somewhat overrated. By empathy, I do not mean acting in a tender, understanding manner. This is support. Support is also highly valued and overrated.
So what is empathy?
Empathy is the ability to comprehend with accuracy the precise thoughts and motivations of other people in such a way that they would say, "Yes, that is exactly where I'm coming from." When you have this extraordinary knowledge, you will understand and accept without anger why others act as they do, even though their actions might not be to your liking. Remember, it is actually your thoughts that create your anger and not the other person's behavior. The amazing thing is that the moment you grasp why the other person is acting that way, this knowledge tends to put the lie to your anger-producing thoughts. You might ask, if it's so easy to eliminate anger through empathy, why do people get so damn mad at each other every day? The answer is that empathy is difficult to acquire. As humans, we are trapped in our own perceptions, and we react automatically to the meanings we attach to what people do. Getting inside the other person's skull requires hard work, and most people don't even know how to do this. Do you? You will learn how in the next few pages. Let's start with an example. A businessman recently sought help because of his frequent episodes of angry outbursts and abusive behavior. When his family or employees didn't do what he wanted, he'd bite their heads off. He usually succeeded in intimidating people, and he enjoyed dominating and humiliating them. But he sensed that his impulsive explosions ultimately caused problems for him because of his reputation as a sadistic hothead. He described a dinner party he attended where the waiter forgot to fill his wine glass. He felt a surge of rage due to his thought, "The waiter thinks I'm unimportant. Who the hell does he think he is, anyway? I'd like to wring the mother blank's neck." I used the empathy method to demonstrate to him how illogical and unrealistic his angry thoughts were. I suggested that we do some role-playing. He was to play the waiter, and I would act the part of a friend. He was to try to answer my questions as truthfully as possible. The following dialogue evolved.
David, playing the role of the waiter's friend.
I noticed that you didn't fill the wine glass of that businessman there.
Patient, playing the role of waiter.
Oh, I see that I didn't fill his glass.
Why didn't you fill his glass? Do you think he is an unimportant person?
Well, no, it wasn't that. I actually don't know much about him. But didn't you decide that he was an unimportant person and refused to give him any wine because of that?
No, that isn't why I didn't give him any wine.
Then why didn't you give him wine?
Well, I was daydreaming about my date for tonight. Furthermore, I was looking at that pretty girl across the table. I was distracted by her low-cut dress, and I just overlooked his wine glass.
This role-playing episode created great relief for the patient because by placing himself in the waiter's shoes, he was able to see how unrealistic his interpretation had been.
His cognitive distortion was jumping to conclusions, mind-reading. He automatically concluded the waiter was being unfair, which made him feel he had to retaliate to maintain his self-pride. Once he acquired some empathy, he was able to see that his righteous indignation was caused entirely and exclusively by his own distorted thoughts and not the waiter's actions. It is often extremely difficult for angry-prone individuals to accept this at first because they have a nearly irresistible